Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello, my friends, and happy Monday. What a thrill it is to be talking to you on a Monday. This is very unusual. Welcome to Catch Up with Louise McSharry. This is a podcast that tries to keep you caught up on everything from news to entertainment to just cool things that people are doing, cool people who have cool things to say. So this is obviously the first of a thrice weekly. Oh my God, I love any opportunity to use the word thrice. This is the first thrice weekly podcast where we are taking the segments that normally came together in a Friday episode. If you're listening for the first time, this is your explanation. If you know the story, then I'm sorry for boring you. But previously, we would have given you all of those things in one episode. And by we, I mean me and my brilliant contributors. But now we are separating them out. So today, you're going to get the news catch up. And in fairness, myself and Carl were saying we didn't, like, so much news happened over the weekend. There was loads to talk about. And that's the beauty of this now, is that we have the time to, you know, really get into all the stories. Then you will, on Wednesday morning, you'll wake up and you'll have an episode from me, a catch up on the world of entertainment. So, like, for example, the BAFTAs we'll be talking about on Wednesday, and who knows what else. And then on Friday, you're going to get an interview that you can listen to at any time you want over the weekend, someone who's doing something cool. So yeah, I hope you enjoy it. For now, this Monday episode will be going out kind of around 10 o'clock-ish on a Monday morning. Obviously, we're recording it first thing, and then I need to edit it and get it up and stuff. So there was no way for me to make it so that it would be there when you wake up, unless I work on a Sunday, which currently I just don't think is going to happen. Blah, 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 blah. Trying to make this sustainable and consistent for you. So hopefully the mid-morning episode will work for you. And yeah, I just hope you like it in general. I'm really excited to be talking to you a few times a week, and very excited just to have the space to kind of get into things a little bit more, should we wish. Yeah, so that's the business end. Don't forget as well, by the way, if 3 times a week isn't enough for you, oh my God. Or if you just are like, hey, Louise is actually doing quite a lot of work on this podcast, I would like to support her, then you could go to Patreon, patreon.com/catchupwithlouisemcsharry, and any few quid thrown my way means I can feed my children. So yeah, all those things gratefully received. I hope you had a great weekend, my friends. I hope you did something fun. If you didn't, no worries. They can't all be fun. I was very lucky. I had a great weekend. I went to visit a friend of mine in Amsterdam. She moved there about 9 months ago. And I was just, you know, when you have a good friend that moves away, I mean, first of all, it's a loss, obviously. But second of all, you just want to see their life. So I was really dying to see her life that she'd set up and the new friends she'd made. And CMAT was playing on Thursday night with support from Morgana, previously of Saint Sister, and now she's doing her own thing, and she is so good. That was my, did I see her twice at Other Voices? Second or third time going to see her, and I've been lucky enough to listen to the music as well, and she is just going to blow everyone's minds. She is so, so good. The music she's doing on her own is amazing. And so it was really exciting to see her supporting CMAT. She's supporting CMAT at all her European shows. So if you're listening in a European city and you have tickets to go and see her, make sure you go early to see Morgana as well, because she is just so good. And CMAT was obviously brilliant, like always, always is. And then I got to hang out in Amsterdam all weekend and eat delicious food and go for nice drinks and meet cool people. And yeah, I really, really loved it. But you'll hear more, a little bit more about that with me and Carl, because obviously Carl lives in Amsterdam. So we had to have a little catch up. So there you go. Let's get going. Our first standalone news episode. Ooh, I'm like scared and excited. I feel like I'm having a baby. I hope you like it. Well, good morning, Carl Kinsella. Our first Monday morning conversation. How are you?
Yeah, it feels a bit strange, doesn't it? Monday morning.
I think it's more intense.
It feels a bit more serious or something.
It does feel a bit more serious.
Monday morning is serious business.
Yeah, it does feel like it's business time, but it also feels exciting to me.
Yeah, I think I feel like it'll galvanize us. You know, I feel like the week is just beginning. Mm. We're ready to just dive straight in to the news.
We've got to get the people caught up. How are you? How was your weekend? I was in your city, but I unfortunately did not see you.
Yeah, it was a flying. I got a text from Emer McCauley, my colleague on Thursday night with the two of you in it, and also another friend.
Had a great time. Many people approached me and said, I know Carl Kinsella. I was like, hey. Yeah, I had a great time. Yeah, Amsterdam is so great.
It is lovely, yeah. I really like it. The weather was fairly miserable when you were here. That's right. It's been pretty rainy this weekend.
Yeah, but like,
I suppose it's rainy in Ireland.
Exactly. Yeah. It just felt like being at home, to be honest, weather-wise. But no, I was really impressed by Amsterdam as a city. I'd been there a couple of times, but I think it's always different when you're visiting someone who lives there. And I was visiting a friend of mine who lives there, and a lot of her friends have been there for years. So they really know the city well. And I was like quizzing them on all kinds of pieces of information that I find interesting, like how much taxes do you pay, what do you get for those taxes, like how does this work, how does that work, what's the political system like, and I was really just impressed by the overall feeling of the city. I love how you can look in everybody's windows. That was something that I particularly enjoyed. Do you spend your time looking in people's windows?
I did actually notice yesterday that when I was walking home, I was like, I was paying closer attention than usual to my neighbors, as like the fronts of their houses. I was like, yeah, let's have a look. Let's find out who these people really are. It is a lovely city. Like I think it doesn't stress you out as much as most major cities do, because I think the public transport is so like efficient and widespread, and like because so many people are cycling, it just feels like there's a lot of space. Which I think is a good feeling for a city to give off.
Yeah, now I will say I only spoke to two Dutch people outside of like being in a restaurant or whatever the entire weekend. All of my friends are like Irish and English and stuff. That one girl has a Dutch boyfriend who was absolutely lovely. And then I just had a very brief conversation with a Dutch woman in a toilet queue. And it was very amusing to me because she said, where are you from? And I said, Ireland. And she said, where in Ireland? And I said, Dublin. And she went, like, ugh. And I was like, oh, yeah, I love this directness. And I was like, okay, where is that? What's that about? Where is that coming from? And she was like, she said, I've been there twice. Nobody lives in the city. There's no people in the city. It really doesn't have the energy that we have here. Because in Amsterdam, you can be like in the busiest place and then there will be people living right there, families living right there. Like everybody, all the housing and city is all integrated. And she was really unimpressed by that. And I have to say it was something that I had already been thinking about. So I enjoyed her pointing that out to me.
Yeah, for sure. Although I do think it's just the most Dutch thing in the world to be like, oh, what city are you from? And then you tell them what city you're from and they're like, oh, my city's better. You know, and just like,
yeah. Well, I have to say, I kind of agree after this weekend. Anyway, I'm actually planning to write my opinion column for the Indo this week about that kind of
Oh, cool.
Interaction and how I felt about what I saw in Amsterdam. So I have to say, spoiler, I kind of agree with her at the moment. And I love Dublin, but it is bringing me down a bit at the moment. Anyway, we have got actually lots of news to discuss. We didn't really know how it was going to go, given the fact that we only just talked about the news on Thursday. And obviously, it's normally a week between our conversations. But there's actually so much to discuss. A lot of stuff happened over the weekend. We've got some juicy stuff to get into. So we might as well get going. We will start appropriately, I think, in Gaza, where things continue, but there have been some interesting incidents over the last few days.
Yeah, well, currently sort of the state of play, as we know, the IDF are kind of, they're pushing in on Rafah, which is a city in the very south of Gaza. And the US and various other major Israeli allies, including, you know, Canada, UK, Australia, New Zealand, they are essentially, in public at least, they are pleading with Israel not to embark on a sort of a ground incursion into Rafah. They don't want to see the bloodshed. This is kind of, you know, it feels a bit sort of too little too late in terms of these countries have provided unbelievable material support for the IDF over the last 4 months. And not just material support, but sort of like PR support in terms of just insisting that Israel has a right to defend itself, et cetera, and that Hamas needs to be wiped off the face of the earth, which, I mean, regardless of anyone's feelings on Hamas, this operation since October 7th, it has failed to root out Hamas. You know, the IDF are still sort of, you know, from the outside looking in, looks like just sort of blindly bombing Gaza with the, you know, the eventual goal of seemingly reducing it to so much rubble that Hamas can't even function. Mm. But that's kind of what's happening with Rafah. But what Netanyahu has said this week is that if, you know, and this, you know, it doesn't really pass muster, but the IDF line is that if Hamas was to release all the hostages that were captured on October 7th, then this would all end and they'll be able to sort of quote unquote enjoy Ramadan in peace, which is what the IDF, that's kind of what the Israeli government is pushing right now. But it feels almost sort of mocking, you know, I feel like it doesn't feel like a very sincere. Because I mean, we're at this total impasse. Hamas are not going to release the hostages because Israel won't make any concessions on their side. Mm. They won't release the many prisoners they have, and they talk about, you know, consistently talk about how the idea of a ceasefire is fantastical and, you know, kind of crazy and the kind of thing that you would only come up with if you didn't understand the situation. So they're very, very down on the idea of a ceasefire. Mm. And it doesn't feel like that's something we're going to get right now. So right now it is still a case of, you know, fighting on the kind of outskirts of Rafah and other major, like other big sites, like the Nasser Hospital, which is one of the last remaining functioning hospitals in Gaza. Mm. So that's where we are still.
There was a really powerful piece over the weekend from an American doctor who had gone and worked in a hospital. I don't know if you saw that in Gaza, who was just basically saying that it's beyond any kind of human comprehension what's happening there. Like, I mean, I feel like even though we're being told, we still aren't fully grasping the reality of what people are facing there. And we probably never will. But every time I hear from someone like that, it reminds you again the depths of this. And obviously it's the stories about children that will get you. Like some of the imagery that came out of Rafah last week was, I mean, I don't know how any of us will ever be the same. And yet here we are kind of carrying on with our normal lives.
Yeah, and you have these huge organizations like Médecins Sans Frontières talking about how like medical staff have had to they've had to flee Nasser Hospital this week and leave patients behind, and that the WHO, they showed up to the scene and they weren't allowed access. Mm. So you do just have a total deterioration or like falling apart of all these institutions that I think for a long time people trusted and people kind of thought that, oh, you know, as a global order, if we have all of these institutions keeping things in check, we're not going to have these awful atrocities. Mm. But in this case, it seems to have totally fallen flat, and we're in a situation where, you know, Gaza remains, I think it was roughly 100 people were killed yesterday in airstrikes. Mm. So you're still talking about a huge daily death toll, huge carnage. Mm. And I think that is just, it's very disturbing. And it probably is about to get worse, because we probably are about to see a full ground invasion or incursion into Rafah, which is, there's about 1.5 million people there. Yeah. And what you were saying the other day, that it's about the size of Heathrow Airport. Mm. So it's a real sitting duck situation. Yeah. And it just, you know, you just kind of pray that there's some intervention on the part of the US or somebody in the next couple of days or weeks to try and just subvert some of the kind of violence that we think is going to come.
Yeah. Meanwhile, protests continue around the world. I know there was a really massive one in Dublin over the city. Tens of thousands of people apparently protested. It looked, from what I saw on social media, really powerful. And then right around the country, there were individual protests. You know, the Irish people are still kind of stalwart in their position on this. And I saw that even Bernie Sanders was challenged during an appearance at Trinity College last week.
Yeah, this was interesting because Bernie, obviously, in the context of the US, would be one of the more sort of, I think what you call like a reasonable voice, someone who wants what he calls a humanitarian pause and has been calling that since November. But he is still, you know, part of that US political hierarchy. And that structure is just very pro-Israel. And like we saw it from the kind of at the very outset, he was very slow to sort of to talk about protecting Palestine and protecting civilians. And by sort of, I guess, taking part in the US machine and by, you know, being so slow to sort of come around to what is fairly a standard Irish viewpoint, it means that, yeah, he is definitely open for criticism. And he was called out by a protester. You know, it was that classic chant of something like, Bernie Sanders, you can't hide, you've supported genocide or something like that.
You're denying genocide, I think is what they said, yeah. Because it is, and it's tricky because Bernie Sanders has taken a position on this. Like, he's not pretending like it's okay. He said, you know, just recently on TV, he said, I'll be damned if I'm going to continue to, or if I'm going to give another nickel to the Netanyahu government in order to continue this war against the Palestinian people. You know, he has been calling for it to stop, but basically people are not happy. They say the language is too weak and, you know, you need to call this what it is, which from their position is a genocide. And, you know, that has legal backing now as well via the ICJ. So yeah, I guess, you know, at this point, unless you are very clear about being against what is being done, you know, in very explicit language, it's still not good enough for lots of people. And that's kind of understandable.
Yeah, that's, people want more, especially from someone like Bernie Sanders, who has been at the forefront of so many progressive movements over the last sort of 8 or 9 years, whether it's sort of healthcare or whether it's a cost of living crisis, that kind of thing. You know, Sanders is always someone who has framed himself as on the side of the people. And he also has more of an opportunity because he's not a member of the Democratic Party. He is an independent. So he doesn't necessarily need to follow the rules in the same way that another Democrat might. So he has scope to speak his mind, and he has always spoken his mind. And I think that's what's frustrating for people, is because they see it and they think, oh, like, deep down, he must truly believe to some extent in the legitimacy of at least, you know, this, you know, fight back or this idea of Israel's right to defend itself. As you say, in the last couple of months, he has been pretty forthright. Like, you know, it is clear, he's made it clear that he does not support what Israel is doing. You know, so I think, yeah, you can interrupt his speaking event and that's fine, but like, yeah, he's not at the absolute top rung of people who could sort of stand up and call a halt to this. And I think he's doing a certain amount, but yeah, like, I think it's just the difference between the political context in America and Ireland. Like, because in Ireland it's so commonplace to be supportive of Palestine and to, you know, want the Palestinian people to have their own state and for them to be safe and for them to be healthy, that I think it's very confounding for Americans. And even the little bit that they do in support of Palestine, when they come here, it's kind of blown out of the water. Because as you saw, you know, there was tens of thousands of people marched in Ireland this weekend. So like, it's, you know, and like, obviously Ireland, Leo Varadkar wrote that letter with the Prime Minister of Spain. So this is a country where there is just broad support for Palestinian independence and freedom. And yeah, I think it's very hard for an American to sort of keep up with that. So I think ultimately, yeah, probably no surprise that, I think it was quite a small protest. Like, I don't think it wasn't as if hundreds of people stood outside the room while Bernie Sanders was talking and tried to call him off. I didn't really love his response to the protester. He said something like, oh, I don't like being disrupted, because if you're disrupted, then you never actually get to have a meeting. And I was like, well, like, you know, you're Bernie Sanders, like, you presumably know what protesting is all about. You're familiar with the idea of protesting.
I didn't think that was great either, but I think what he said then was kind of you know, he said, I've talked about my views on Gaza and I'm doing everything I can to end a horrific and terrible war. My dream would be that the president finally wakes up to what I think the American people want and say, you know what, Mr. Netanyahu, you're not going to get another nickel until you stop that damn war and treat the Palestinian people with the respect and dignity they deserve. He said, I have nightmares about what is going on. It is a horror. Believe it or not, I'm trying to do my best to end that war. And I do believe him, actually.
Yeah, it's like, I think he's like, he's late to the party. And yeah. Like, I don't know. I think everybody, I think, always, you know, believes that they're doing kind of all they can. And he probably is doing a lot of what he can. Mm. I think obviously people just want that final step of, yeah, like, as you said, coming out and calling it a genocide.
Yeah.
You know, like, just sort of go full 100%, yeah, full throat on it, you know.
Yeah. Okay, now over the weekend, Alexei Navalny, who is the opposition leader in Russia, or was the opposition leader in Russia, was killed. And this was absolutely enormous news internationally and for Russian people, many of whom I know were extremely upset by this, particularly the people who live kind of internationally. People might have seen, there was a really brilliant documentary made about him, and you might have seen that because it was nominated for an Oscar. But for people who are not familiar with him, who was this guy?
Yeah, so Alexei Navalny, he's been on the scene for, I think, about since 2011, or at least kind of it has had international recognition since then. Mm. As you say, he was the leader of Russia's kind of opposition party, which is obviously in Russia, which is really just a one state country where, you know, Vladimir Putin has been in charge for over 20 years now. Mm. To be in charge of the Russian opposition is kind of like, you know, it's all you're really doing is putting yourself under threat, because you're certainly never going to be, not under the situation as it exists now, you're not, yeah, going to get into power. So it really is just putting a target on your back, which is exactly what happened with Navalny. He ran for mayor of Moscow years ago. So like, he did a lot of things that, and as you say, there was that really popular documentary. So he did a lot of things, had a lot of kind of goodwill on his side that I think, you know, Putin just, he couldn't handle. So I think had Navalny been weaker, he probably would have been maybe left alone. Mm. But it's just because he was so successful at drumming up support. And, you know, he survived attempts on his life before in 2020. Mm. He had, you know, that famous Novichok nerve agent that was used in Salisbury in around 2017. He was a victim of that kind of attack.
So it's like it's a poison, basically.
It's, yeah, a nerve gas. Yeah, a horrible type of poison. And yeah, so he is... he had been in prison. He had, even in 2023, he was sentenced to a further 19 years in prison. And like, you know, these are all just for like, you know, kind of trumped up political charges that, you know, really don't seem to have any bearing in reality. So this guy was just sort of enemy number one for Vladimir Putin for a very long time. The official account of his death is that he has died of just sudden death syndrome, which, you know, I think anyone who has been paying attention to the behavior of the Kremlin over the last, I mean, forever, will probably be skeptical about that. I mean, you know, just months ago, we had a situation where the leader of the Wagner Group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, he tried to stage a coup. He tried to march on Moscow. Mm. You know, that sort of diffused, and he was put on a plane to Belarus. And within a couple of months, he had died in a plane crash. Mm. So, you know, you do get a lot of these suspicious deaths with high profile sort of enemies of Vladimir Putin, and Navalny now sadly seems to be added to that list. And yeah, there's been a huge sort of outcry, a lot of outpouring of sort of sadness for Navalny. And like, by the way, you know, we don't need to get into the weeds of this too much, but like, Navalny is by no means, from the international perspective, a perfect person. You know, like, if someone from Ireland was to go through the list of sort of ideological standpoints that Navalny has, they'd probably find themselves disagreeing with a lot of it, particularly when it comes to like Russian nationalism and like his attitude towards kind of other minorities within Russia, of which there are loads. So, you know, it's not necessarily 100% simple, but I suppose what is simple is that, you know, the death of an opposition leader in such an autocratic, dangerous country is just, you know, it's the kind of thing that you shake your head at. And it's something that I noticed a lot of people when it first happened, it was a very grim feeling, because it really cements that idea that Putin is just, you can't dislodge him, you know, and you can't even sort of make an impact, can't put a scratch on him. And I think that's how a lot of people felt in the aftermath. I know like Russians came out to pay their respects. There's more than 400 people detained, which, I mean, if 400 people were detained, then you must have had thousands of people coming out in support of him after he died. But I mean, like, for me, it was just
where he died is described as a remote Arctic prison colony. Like, you know, it sounds grim. And in, you know, the Kremlin are saying that they're not responsible for it, but internationally, you know, political leaders are saying that they are responsible for his death one way or the other. And yeah, hundreds of people in cities all across Russia have kind of been protests or have been marking his death with, you know, laying flowers, that kind of thing. But mad to think that people would be arrested within that. 400 people arrested within that is mad. And the charges are things like organizing a rally. And, you know, it's just, you know, Russian people are not free.
No, absolutely not. And it just goes to show, like, when you have these, you know, what I think you can estimate are thousands of people coming out under the duress of possibly being arrested in a country where we've just seen, you know, an opposition political leader suffer the kind of pay the ultimate price for standing up to Putin. I think it's a real testament to how many people there probably are in Russia who would like change.
Yeah.
But like, as we can see, you know, if you have someone like Navalny, like this person with international sort of claim and backing, and people really like him, his likability and stuff. Mm. And even he really can't, as we say, he can't even put a scratch on Putin. It is very disturbing. And I think it's going to have a hugely chilling effect in Russia and probably a chilling effect internationally, because absolutely. It is, it's just, you know, when you sort of lose someone who's a sort of a figurehead and representative of the idea of an opposition in Russia, you know, we've lost that kind of person now. So I think that is, it's very disturbing for people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Okay, let's move to RTE again. It's funny, last week we were like, will we even talk about this? Because it's kind of boring and everybody's sick of it. But then the drama just continues. Like, it seems unending.
They really deliver. Like, honestly, if their instincts for drama in their, like, fiction department was as strong, their instinct for drama, like, just in their normal lives, they would do so much better. Like, if they could have a Succession-style TV show based on the last couple of years at RTE.
I mean, they could. It's true.
They easily could. And you know what I think is actually going to happen is they're going to get gazumped and Virgin Media will come in. Mm. And Virgin Media will make a really good show about RTE. And it'll just be, you know, it'll just be like an unending spiral for it. And like right now, it does feel like an unending spiral. You know, when you hear about these sort of the golden handshake payments and more, it does just make you want to tear your hair out.
Yeah. And that is where the focus is now. Like, you know, we've kind of moved on slightly from the toy show, the musical, to these numerous golden handshake payments, which is basically when you give someone money to kind of go away, essentially, isn't it?
Pretty much. Or, well, in the case of Breida O'Keefe, it was interesting because it was just voluntary. Like, typically when you're talking about a golden handshake, yeah, like it's because you want to get rid of someone. Mm. And like it's sort of like almost a kind of an unofficial severance or a bonus just to get you out the door. Mm. But like with Breida O'Keefe, there was no real suggestion that she was the CFO,
yeah,
who is kind of the center of the biggest payment. She got $450,000. There was no suggestion that they were kind of kicking her out. She was leaving.
She was done, yeah.
And there was simply no, you know, no good reason. And like in that case, you are just talking about a bonus in the same way that a banker, you know, like back in the day would get a huge bonus. You're just talking about sort of the kind of bonus where the justification for it is that, oh, it incentivizes the best people to go for the job, you know. So it's not really about a severance, and it's more about an incentive. And but it's just so silly because, I mean, first of all, with RTE at the top level, I don't know. There doesn't seem to be any evidence to me that we are getting the best people for the job in any of these positions. And then, like, B, it is just so much money, and it's so much, you know, kind of public. There's at least public contribution to the money.
Yeah.
So, and like, it's funny this week, you know, Micheál Martin called for full transparency of salaries and packages at RTE. Like, I really thought that was ground we covered last summer. Like, I thought they had agreed to that. Maybe they haven't agreed. I thought they had agreed to that already. You know, like,
no, there's back and forth, because I think the problem, one of the main things to remember is that there are many hundreds of people who work in RTE, and most of them are not well paid and are just normal people doing normal jobs. And so I think that does make it tricky when we have these conversations about full transparency of salaries and packages, because, like, you know, most people don't really want their salary, you know, they don't really want this conversation to be in the news. And I think there is sometimes there is a tendency to allow that to color the kind of transparency of salaries at the top level. Like, I personally feel like there should be no question that, like, salaries at management level at this point should be completely out in the open and clear. Like, you know, I know they've gone back and forth on it, but it seems like things are just too bleak. I mean, like, I know they've been called in for a meeting this morning, because of all what's gone on over the last week. Because it wasn't just, initially we talked about Breida O'Keefe already, but then there was a Simon Coveney one as well that came out over the weekend. Or Rory Coveney, excuse me. Jeez.
Rory Coveney. Yeah.
Sorry, not Simon Coveney. They are two different people, albeit related. Yeah, Rory Coveney, who was director of strategy, also got a big payment. I did not receive a single payment upon leaving RTE, I would just like to say, and I could really have done with it, but it doesn't apply to people like me or anyone normal who works there.
You would have deserved it too. And it's so, I think the Rory Coveney one is so grieving, because it's kind of, he is almost, if you read the sort of the transcripts from the various hearings we've had, he's the man who's kind of almost almost single-handedly pushed for the toy show, the musical. Like, it really was his baby. It was his project. So the fact that sort of he was, you know, and again, like, he was involved last summer. Like, he was in the hearings last summer. So he, you know, again, there was no real need for him to have such an enormous payout. And he got 1 year's whole salary. So, like, again, you're talking about huge money for someone who has, I mean, like, the Toy Show musical, which was his idea, lost RTE another 2.2 million. So we're just talking about, like, an enormous financial footprint on all these people. You know, when all is said and done, you're looking at these people who come in with ideas, the ideas lose money, and then the people leave, and then you have to pay the people even more money. So it's just sort of, as we say, like, it's a spiral. And, you know, last week we were talking about, like, yeah, Kevin Backhurst has his work cut out for him, and it does seem, and like we talked about this as well, like, as you say, him and Shuni Rahli, the chair of the board, are being called into Catherine Martin's office today, and, like, kind of, I assume what they'll discuss is probably RTE being brought under the remit of the Comptroller and Auditor General, which is like a government appointed position, and they audit all the state's spending, so RTE could kind of fall under that, and maybe that'll be the consequence of the meeting. But I mean, it's just I don't know. I don't see how it's so bad for like the license fee. It's so bad for public trust. I think just think people have so little time for all these shenanigans. Mm. People just want to have good quality public broadcasting. They don't want to have to deal with all these egos and personalities and salaries and packages. So I don't know, maybe it'll end up being like a good kind of clearing up house, but like, you know, I think that remains to be seen.
Yeah. And it's certainly rolling on and on. A pretty bleak thing happened last week during the celebrations over the Super Bowl in America. There was a shooting at a celebratory parade for the Kansas City Chiefs. And I have to say, like, I was surprised by how little I felt when I heard about this. And then that made me feel really bleak and sad.
Yeah, I think it's definitely reached a stage now, because I could even, yeah, if you could trace sort of the evolution, I think, of how people outside of America react to shootings. And, you know, even a couple of years ago, you would have had major shootings that elicit total horror and almost like a shutdown of the news for the whole day, like and the entire news focused around this thing. Whereas now I do definitely think we're in a position where, so I was reading, it's something like 49 mass shootings in the US in 45 days in 2024. So it is just pretty much constant. Like, you're looking at it, you know, at least once a day. And I think when you see it at an event like this, where there's already some attention on it, I think people are starting to almost expect it. Like, we had a very similar shooting, I think it was after an NBA celebration last year, with the Denver Nuggets. There was a shooting, and there was a major shooting, I think, on the 4th of July in 2022 in Illinois. So like, you're looking at like these major events now, like these things that everybody goes to, like, say, if you think of an Irish equivalent, like, imagine if you couldn't go to a Paddy's Day parade or New Year's Eve, you know, the celebrations on the Keys in Dublin, if you couldn't turn up to that without kind of almost a presumption that someone is going to start firing a gun at some point, it doesn't feel like a real society. It's so surreal and so, you know, it just doesn't really compute, you know? And I think that's what's understand, I think, you know?
Yeah, I saw a guy who was interviewed kind of around it, and he kind of, this is not literally what he said, but the vibe was, sure, there's always one. And like, no.
Yeah.
Like, that should not be exactly the way with fatal shootings, or like, even, you know, shootings where people are seriously injured. Now, in this situation, one person died, 22 other people were injured, and two teenagers have been charged, both under 18. Like, how are teenagers getting the gun? Like, we've discussed this. How are they getting the guns?
Yeah, and supposedly the intel that the police have is that it all stemmed from like a personal dispute. Like, it wasn't a case of two people showing up to commit a mass shooting. It was that two people got into an argument, and as a result, you know, dozens of people got shot, which is just like, how can you live in a situation like that? And, you know, it's also very frustrating. You see, like, the quarterback from the Kansas City Chiefs, Patrick Mahomes, he's like the best paid NFL player in like history. He came out like right away with a tweet that was just like, you know, thoughts and prayers, you know, pray for Kansas. And it's just like, this is the city that you live in, that you play sport in. You should have like a connection to these people. And it really, for me, what I find so disturbing is just the mealy-mouthedness of, like, you could have someone like, you know, this is Travis Kelce's team. This is the team that Taylor Swift has famously been turning up to watch week in, week out. And like, not that like solving gun crime is Travis Kelce's responsibility or Patrick Mahomes's or Taylor Swift's, but they could do so much more. They could say so much more. They could make it an actual campaign.
Yeah, they could.
And it seems like those days are gone. You know, like, I feel like back in the day, you would have something like a shooting at, like, at Parkland in Florida, and all those kids kind of became sort of influencers and social media stars because they were pushing so hard. And it doesn't feel like you get those reactions anymore. It does feel like a shrug of the shoulders, where it's like, I think it is sort of like the anti-gun or the gun control crowd has sort of accepted defeat.
Yeah.
It's sort of how it feels to me.
Yeah. It's awful.
It is awful.
The Social Democrats had their conference over the weekend, and Holly Cairns gave her first kind of, I don't know, what did she call it? Speech. I mean, it wasn't her first speech, but like, as in terms of being leader of the Social Democrats at the Social Democrats National Conference, and it seems to have gone down very well.
Yeah, I get the sense that like most of what Holly Cairns has done and said since becoming SocDem leader has has gone down well.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like they have, like, I think, you know, some people might attribute that to the youth. I think I would attribute it to, obviously, people remember before Holly Kearns, Sock Dems had two leaders. So they had Roisin Shorthall and Catherine Murphy working together as co-leaders. And I just think that doesn't work. I think people just want to see one leader. I think it makes so much more sense to just have one person sort of delivering these speeches. And yeah, I think, you know, Holly Kearns, I think it has helped her kind of unifying it in that way. But yeah, I think probably what people mostly took away from the speech is she promised that if she got into government, or if Sock Dems got into government, it would be 50,000 homes per year would be built. That would be pretty staggering. Is 10,000 affordable homes and 12,000 social homes per year. Like, that's the kind of thing that I think it's quite clever, because if you look at the popularity Sinn Féin have had over the last couple of years, I think it's almost all down to housing. And I think if Sock Dems could also capture some of that ground with a very ambitious housing plan, that would help them out. They also are also kind of the originators through Roisin Shorthall of Sláintecare. And Holly Kearns said a red line for her going into government would be like the acceleration of Sláintecare. Now, in order to get Sláintecare working, which is universal healthcare for all Irish people, you'd need some serious acceleration. Like, it's so far behind schedule. But it's a good red line to have. In a different interview, Kearns said that she wouldn't rule out going into government with any party, which is the kind of thing that, like, that'll really upset some, say, Sinn Féin and people before profit people, because it suggests, you know, she'd go into a government with Fine Gael, and it'll also upset Fine Gael people, because it suggests she might go into government with Sinn Féin. But ultimately, like, with a party as small as Sock Dems, they have 6 seats. Who knows how many seats they'll have after the next election? You know, I think it's sort of it's harder to argue kind of being a protest party when you're so small. You know, I think it's unlikely that Sock Dems are going to be, like, calling the shots in any meaningful way, whether they're in opposition.
Exactly. There's just not enough of them. They're a new party. They'd need to get a lot of people kind of running for election. That would require a lot of money and a lot of organization. Like, these things just don't tend to happen quickly. That's why Sinn Féin were in the position they were in the last election, where, you know, they potentially could have won more seats, but they just didn't have enough candidates. So, you know, I would imagine that they will do well, but it's going to be slow. But it just seems so wild to me that, like, it's kind of remarkable that we have this political party and a leader of a political party who are just kind of, you know, sound just like, hey, let's not be racist. Let's try and build more houses so that people can actually have homes. Let's try and make it so that people aren't desperate to leave the country. Let's try and do everything we can to fight this genocide. Like, those are not extreme or radical views from the conversations that I have with people. I mean, obviously, I'm kind of, you know, I would be left-leaning progressive, but, like, you know, it's remarkable, I think, is remarkable.
Yeah, I think their outward niceness is honestly very impressive. Like, they really it doesn't tend to look like ever. Like, they're always just pretty nice. And even, like, online, if you ever have to deal with, like, a Sock Dems, you know, say sometimes you get, like, a Sinn Féin person in your DM, or not in your DMs, but in your replies, or, like, definitely lots of Fine Gael people in your replies, or Fianna Fáil giving out to you for this or that. You don't really get that with Sock Dems people. Like, they're usually just pretty friendly. Almost makes me, like, suspicious of them. You know, it's like, what are they doing over there with their purple t-shirts?
I love it.
Also, I really like that you can say their name, like, perfectly to the tune of Roxanne by The Police. Like, you can be like, Sock Dems. 10 out of 10.
Carl, you should sell that idea to them. That's a top tier idea. Before I let you go, I just wanted to, this was the story we were going to do last week, but we didn't have time to get to in the end, which is the story of romance scams, and unfortunately lots of people being taken in by them. Now, this is, romance scams, I feel like, is something that people will be kind of vaguely familiar via TV programs like 90 Day Fiancé and the like. But, you know, for those who don't know, what's the story here?
Yeah, so a romance scam is kind of, I mean, it sort of is what it sounds like, which is where, you know, people are contacted or communicated with almost always digitally. And it's, you know, whether it's on Facebook or whether it's through a dating app, someone will have basically set up a catfish account, which is a fake account using fake pictures. You know, it could be anyone anywhere in the world, just using the pictures of someone, you know, to sort of... to lure them in. And usually the way it goes is they build trust, they have a conversation, you know, you might match with them on Tinder, and they'll, you know, they'll sweet talk you, and they'll be nice to you, and they'll, you know,
make you feel special.
Yeah, they're mostly targeting, I think, you know, ultimately probably people who are lonely, and maybe people who kind of want to feel special, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then it builds up over time, and they start asking for money, and they need money for this or that, or you send me this money and I'll come visit you.
Yeah,
or
money for plane tickets. Yeah,
exactly.
My mother is sick.
Precisely, and it's actually crazy how successful some of these scams are. You know, Gardaí said that 245 victims have come forward since 2020. So that's quite a lot, you know, and that, like, it's 7 million euro has been stolen through these scams over the last 5 years. Like, you know, it's the kind of thing that if it doesn't really touch your life, you know, if you're happily married or happily in a relationship, you probably never think about these things.
No.
But, like, there are people who do end up getting victimized by these things, and it is really sad.
It's so sad.
And it's the kind of, it's really sad, and it's the kind of thing that, like, it's very, very preventable.
Yeah.
And I think people just need to, you know, if there's any, you know, anybody who's sort of in danger, anybody who's been chatting with someone online who they have absolutely no sort of evidence that they're real, like, you want, and the Gardaí, to be fair, gave a lot of advice.
Yeah.
Like, they said that, you know, to do a Google reverse image search,
yeah,
on any, like, picture of a person that you match with, that kind of thing.
Mm.
For me, like, an easy thing is, like, if you go on someone's dating app or on their Facebook and they don't have photos of them with anyone else, or, like, there's no comments on their photos from, like, family and friends, that's a big red flag.
Yeah.
I think you just want to, you keep your eyes open and make sure that people are, like, that they exist in society. You know, you want to be able to find them on LinkedIn. You want to be able to see what they do.
But also look out for your family members, like, you know, people who might be vulnerable in this kind of situation. Like, I read that the highest reported loss by a woman in Ireland was over 450,000 euro stolen in 18 transactions. And then a male victim had 380,000 euro taken. Like, it's really, you know, it's life ruining stuff. And yeah, we just all need to, unfortunately, loneliness is an absolute blight on people in this country. And so we all need to be looking out for each other and looking out for our family members. Well, Carl, that's it. We've done it now. We've done our first standalone news chat episode. Thank you so much for talking to me first thing on a Monday morning. I hope, my friends who are listening, that you have enjoyed this. I have enjoyed it. Have you enjoyed it?
Oh, I've had a great time, yeah.
We've had a ball. I mean, what's not to like?
Great way to start the week.
Well, thank you very much. I can't even speak now. That's me. That's when I do more than half an hour talking. I apparently lose the ability to talk. Thank you very much, and we will talk to you next week. Obviously, you can catch Carl on thejournal.ie. You can read his writing there. If you didn't read his Cerealing in the Years column over the weekend, I highly recommend it. And then where else can the people find you, Carl?
People can get me on Twitter at TV's Carl Kinsella and on Instagram at carl.kinsella.
Lovely. Thank you so much.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Flimsy stains slowing you down? Well, it's time to upgrade. Armadillo builds durable, North American-made tablet stands and kiosks. We're so confident, we offer a lifetime warranty. So, elevate your business and visit armadillo.com. That's armodillo.com and use code ACAST for 5% off. Armadillo. Built to last. Designed to impress.